From the President's office in the White House in Washington, D.C., NBC presents a report by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, on the recent NATO conferences in Paris. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my friends. For the fifth time within the past 5 years, the Secretary of State and I have, together, returned to Washington after international conferences on foreign soil. This time, we have just come from a Paris meeting with heads of government of the 14 other NATO nations. In addition to the scheduled NATO meetings last week, I had individual conferences with most of the heads of government. In these, more was involved than mere expressions of mutual goodwill. In each, the purpose was to discuss frankly our viewpoints about problems of common interest, to remove obstacles to mutual understanding. In the debates of the full conference, there were thoroughly discussed specific problems of every conceivable nature, so as to eliminate deficiencies in our collective arrangements. It was an inspiring experience to watch, in these meetings, common policies take shape affecting the great questions of peace, security, and unity. Planning for carrying into effect these policies was likewise necessary. In this work, all of us found a special advantage, which came out of the bringing together of heads of government. In this way, there was placed behind NATO's future programs the authority and influence which these leaders hold. There was one basic purpose implicit in every discussion and debate of the conference. That was the pursuit of a just peace. Not once during the week did I hear any slightest hint of saber rattling or of aggressive intent. Of course, all of us were concerned with developing the necessary spiritual, economic, and military strength of our defensive alliance. We are determined that there must be no war. But we never lost sight of our hope that the men in the Kremlin would themselves come to understand their own need for peace, as well as our sincerity in desiring a just composition of differences between West and East. At the end, the conference unanimously adopted a declaration of principles to guide future NATO efforts and plans. Measures were adopted for effective scientific and economic cooperation and coordination. We arranged for procedures to ensure timely and close political consultation among ourselves with respect to any problem that might arise. A large list of other matters engaged our attention. To discuss a few of these in some detail, I have asked the Secretary of State to make a brief report, as well as to give now some of his reactions and impressions of the conference.
As you say, Mr. President, every thought, every action taken at that NATO Council meeting was in terms of peace. How would it be possible to achieve a just and a durable peace? We did not think that such a peace could be achieved through weakness. Time after time, despots have struck when they thought they had a clear military advantage. We did not think that such a peace could be achieved in disunity. Time after time, peaceful nations have succumbed because they stood alone. We did accept the view that peace requires an accommodation of viewpoints, and that no nation or group of nations, however right they may feel they are, can expect to have their way 100%. These three themes, unity, strength, and flexibility, were the background for the decisions of this NATO Council meeting of last week. The North Atlantic Council has always had a December meeting at which it took major decisions for the coming year or years. And this year, the matters up for decision were of unusually great importance. And by that, I do not mean to suggest that we had in mind anything that was surprising or spectacular. Indeed, we deliberately avoided the spectacular. all the decisions are what you might call common sense decisions. But common sense, unfortunately, is not always common. And it is a tribute to NATO that it has demonstrated a capacity to act in accordance with what is logical and sensible. Now, the decisions that attracted the most attention were, of course, those that dealt with nuclear weapons and missiles. The NATO countries, including the United States, have long and earnestly studied the need of making these weapons available on the continent of Europe. Our purpose has been to be strong, but not to be provocative. And we all have been hopeful that the Soviet Union would agree to the Western proposals for a worldwide ending of the production of nuclear weapons and the gradual absorption of existing stockpiles of nuclear material into peaceful purpose stocks. That Western proposal, which could be capitulated perhaps in terms of the slogan, "Stop Making Bombs," that's been overwhelmingly endorsed by the United Nations. And the only votes in opposition to that "Stop Making Bombs" proposal were the Soviet bloc. But that opposition was violent. The Soviet rulers seemed determined to go on building up nuclear weapons and missiles, stubbornly apparently clinging to the hope that they may yet, through power, dominate the world. And in the face of that stubborn persistence, it would be folly, as the NATO Council said, to accept the Soviet view that the Soviet Union should have nuclear weapons and missiles with which to threaten Europe, while Western Europe itself should have for its defense only weapons of the pre-atomic age. So the Council decided to establish stocks of nuclear warheads to be readily available in case of need. The NATO Council also decided that intermediate-range ballistic missiles should be put at the disposal of the Supreme Allied Commander for Europe. And these decisions, of course, Mr. President, were unanimous decisions because the Council only acts through unanimity. It will be some little time before these intermediate missiles can actually be put in place on the continent of Europe. And if in the meantime there should be a disarmament agreement, obviously that disarmament agreement would take priority. We all hope that there will be such an agreement, and we shall try in all realistic ways to bring it about. The Council certainly made that clear. Now, the difficulties in the way have unhappily been compounded by the Soviets. For now, they don't merely reject the substance of our proposals, the Western proposals, to stop making bombs, to stop testing bombs, and to have inspection as against surprise attack. They not only reject the substance of these matters, but now they also reject any procedure even for discussing them. For several years now, they've been negotiating through the procedure established by the United Nations. The Soviet Union says it will no longer take part in any discussions of the United Nations Disarmament Commission. Just a few days ago, the United Nations, in an effort to meet the Soviet viewpoint, reconstituted this Disarmament Commission in accordance with a proposal that was made by India, Sweden, and Japan. That was thought to be a conciliatory gesture toward the Soviet Union, but that gesture also has now been rebuffed. Today, the Soviets talk vaguely about turning the whole matter over to the United Nations. But of course, 82 nations obviously can't be a negotiating body. What they can do is they can pronounce on general principles, but that the United Nations has already done. It has endorsed the Western proposals by an overwhelming vote, with the Soviet bloc being absolutely alone in opposition. And another thing that 82 nations can do is to set up a committee or a subcommittee to negotiate. That also the General Assembly has done, but the Soviets refused to negotiate in that way. Well, at NATO, in order to break the impasse, see if we could find some way to proceed, we expressed there the willingness to accept any procedures that would promote the implementation of the disarmament proposals that which the United Nations had approved, or to examine any other proposals that might lead to a controlled reduction of armaments. And also, as a matter of procedure, the Council suggested a meeting with the Soviets at the foreign minister level in order to try to break the procedural deadlock. We suggested a meeting at the foreign minister level because earlier this year the Soviet Unions had indicated that they might be interested in that way of procedure. The NATO Council and all of its members are in deadly earnest about this matter. As weapons become more powerful, more destructive, it becomes more urgent that to find reliable ways to curb that destructive power. And the NATO Council made clear its determination to continue probing, to find some evidence that there is within the Soviet Union the goodwill to resume serious efforts to achieve nuclear peace and to put behind us the horrible prospect of nuclear war. And, Mr. President, I can and I do pledge that every resource of the Department of State and of the Foreign Service of the United States is going to be dedicated to that high endeavor under your high direction. Now, of course, we're trying thus to get a disarmament agreement. But until there is a disarmament agreement, and while the Soviets go on piling up their armaments, our own armament must proceed. And if we're going to have armament, we surely ought to have it in the most efficient way that is practical. And so another decision taken by the NATO Council was to seek to use to a greater degree the capacity of our European allies to produce modern weapons delivery systems. The nuclear part of the warhead will, as a matter of simple efficiency and economy, continue, I suppose, for a considerable time to be made primarily by the United States. But the weapons themselves, including the intermediate-range ballistic missiles, can usefully come to be manufactured in Western Europe. And thus the very great scientific, technological, and industrial capabilities of our European allies can be coordinated with our own to serve more effectively the defensive arsenals of the free world. This is going to require us to supply some nuclear data, which so far we have kept closely restricted. That secretive policy of ours goes back to the days when we had a monopoly of atomic weapons, and we hope to dedicate that monopoly to the service of all humanity, the peaceful service of all humanity. The Soviets, as everyone will recall, rejected that gesture, which was unique, I suppose, in the annals of all history. And under the circumstances, it certainly is futile to deny to our allies information which they could use for our common good and information which the Soviets already possess. Now, another matter which we took up in Paris was the making of a greater effort to increase the number of people trained in science and technology. And also, we agreed to an increased pooling of scientific facilities and information and the sharing of tasks. Most of the great technological developments of modern times, both military and non-military, derive from a scientific genius which is not the monopoly of any one nationality. And of course, we all recall that we drew very heavily upon the talent of our European friends when it came to producing the first atomic weapon. There's obvious need today to combine our talents so as to achieve and maintain the leadership in the new fields of limitless possibilities which open up before us. The Council gave a lot of attention to economic matters. We all felt that there was a great danger lest we over-concentrate on military matters and ignore the economic warfare, and the word warfare is the very word used by Khrushchev, the economic warfare that the Soviets have declared on us. The Soviet-Chinese Communist bloc exploits to develop an expanding industrial base, which not only supports a great military machine, but also supplies the rulers with the possibility of making attractive-sounding economic offers to non-communist countries. And by these means, they try to create a dependence upon the communist world and to penetrate into and finally to take over the political and economic system of the now free nations. And that is particularly the case with the less developed countries of Asia and Africa,
which, having newly gained political independence, seek urgently to find ways to lift their people out of that state of stagnant poverty in which freedom cannot tolerate. And it is essential that the free world nations which have amassed capital should increasingly put this to work in the capital-hungry free world nations. Otherwise, they may feel forced to turn to the communist bloc for aid at a price which may be their freedom. At the Paris meeting, it was decided that the NATO nations should seek more efficient means to advance the less developed areas of the free world. And I recall, Mr. President, that you told the NATO meeting of your proposal to ask the Congress for additional resources for this purpose. This is as necessary as a provision of additional funds for military purposes. And I think, Mr. President, that you would gladly confirm that that is your clear opinion.
With that, I emphatically agree, I would say so.
Well, if we do, as you do and I do, take seriously this political economic warfare that's being waged by the Soviet Union, unless we do take it seriously, we can lose this struggle without ever a shot being fired. The Soviets, by their economic offensive, could take over the underdeveloped countries one by one, and they would thereby increase their own resources in terms of manpower, natural resources, and strategic locations. And by the same token, the United States and its remaining friends would become ever more closely encircled until finally we faced strangulation. Now, my time on this business is running out, Mr. President, so I shall mention only now the matter of developing the habit of NATO political consultations. This is needed to preserve the spirit of unity. Now, last week's meeting was, as you pointed out, particularly significant because it gave the heads of government, as well as the foreign ministers, opportunity to talk together, not merely around a big conference table, but in informal conversations. And that way it was possible to clear up a lot of misunderstandings and to do away with suspicions that in some way we were trying to work against each other in different parts of the world. And at the council meeting, we decided to put forth in the future every effort to carry forward that type of consultations through the regular contacts in Paris of our permanent representatives. These representatives meet in Paris on practically a day-to-day basis. And each of our nations has promised to keep its representative fully informed as to national policies which might have an impact of an important nature upon any other of the allies, so that we can keep each other informed and achieve a greater cooperation, not merely in the interests of the Atlantic community, but in the interests of all the free world. Now, I think it's probably important to note the fact that, of course, NATO doesn't try to run the world or even all the free world, or to rule over the destinies of other countries who are not represented in NATO. Now, I might recall, for the benefit of any who have any fears on this score, that when the United States Senate ratified the North Atlantic Treaty, it did so in reliance of a unanimous report of the Foreign Relations Committee, which said, and I quote, "It would be particularly unfortunate if our government took part in exclusive consultations with Atlantic Pact members over situations of deep concern to friendly states in Asia, Africa, Latin America, or the Middle East." That principle is as sound today as it ever was. It would be disruptive of the unity which is essential within the free world if free world countries who are not members of NATO felt that their fate was being determined by meetings of the NATO Council in their absence. That, it can be said with absolute confidence, is not going to happen. There was no evidence of desire on the part of the NATO Council or any of the members to attempt to set itself up as supreme over other free world countries or other free world organizations. And one evidence of that fact, concrete evidence, is the fact that NATO now has the desire to explore, on a basis of mutuality, the possibility of liaison with other collective defense organizations of a regional character, such as the Organization of American States, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and the Baghdad Pact. The fact is that the peace of any part of the world can be put in jeopardy by what goes on in another part of the world. And so it's in the common interest that there should be efforts to create a sense of cohesion and of confident interdependence as between the free world nations everywhere. And the final declaration to which you alluded, Mr. President, is categorical in this respect. It says, and again I quote, "To all other peoples who, like ourselves, are dedicated to freedom and peace, we offer our cooperation on a basis of complete equality and in the spirit of fraternity." Well, Mr. President, these decisions that I've referred to are, I think you would agree, the most important of the decisions in which we participated. And indeed, those decisions add up to quite a lot, assuming, of course, that they're carried out with vigor. That's going to require sustained effort and sacrifice, perhaps a good deal of sacrifice, on the part of all of us. But the fact that these decisions were taken under these solemn circumstances by the heads of government goes far to assure that these decisions will, in fact, be carried out. And if they are carried out, it's going to give NATO a growing capacity to defend and to nurture the rich heritage of the Atlantic community.
Now, on his way back from Paris, Secretary Dulles briefly visited in Spain. He conferred with General Franco and others in the Spanish government. I know would you like him to take a minute to give you a brief summary of that visit.
Well, Mr. President, I was just saying that there are many strands in the fabric of the free world. NATO doesn't represent them all. And they all have to be carefully nurtured because combined they make the strength which is going to make the free world safe. And my stopover at Madrid illustrates, I think, that point, because Spain is not itself a member of NATO. On the other hand, we do have with Spain important arrangements which contribute very greatly to the strength and defense of the free world and of the NATO area. We have, as a result of agreements which we made about 4 years ago, arrangements for building there a series of air bases and also a naval base for our joint use in Spain and the United States. And the Spanish authorities, when they heard I'd accepted their invitation, were gracious enough to suggest that my plane should come down in one of these new bases that we had jointly built so that I could be welcomed on this new base by the Spanish foreign minister and other Spanish officials. And indeed, it's a really a wonderful air base, perhaps the finest I've ever been on. The runway, I understand, is one of the largest, at least, in the whole world. And from that airfield, I went on to the Pardo Palace, where I had a really good talk with General Franco, the chief of state. We were together for about 3 hours. And I told him about what had been happening at the NATO Council meeting and of the basic policies and the strategies that were being followed. I felt that General Franco, by the contribution that his government was making to the defense of Europe, had clearly entitled himself to that kind of information. And in turn, the Spanish chief of state gave me his estimate of the Soviet threat. And incidentally, his estimate and that of the NATO Council were in very close agreement. And then General Franco and I discussed other problems that were more especially of Spanish United States concern. And I felt there a very genuine spirit of friendship and cordiality, as indeed had been the case when I was in Spain the previous time in November 1955. It's ties like this that hold the free world together, and they provide a striking contrast to the military coercion which alone holds together the countries of the Soviet bloc. Now, of course, as between free nations, there are from time to time differences and dissatisfactions. That is inevitable, however hard or skillfully we strive. But surmounting all is a sense of fellowship which unites those who are dedicated to a common cause and who sacrifice and risk that that cause may prevail. And I should like, Mr. President, to express also our satisfaction that there is unity at home on the essentials. For example, the ideas which we took with us to Paris derive from a broad nonpartisan base, and we are appreciative of such cooperation, as I'm sure is the whole nation. Oftentimes, the dominant mood seems to be one of dissension and perplexity and discouragement. But that impression may well be superficial. Beneath the ruffled surface, there can be a great body of goodwill, confidence, and resolution. And it's particularly appropriate that at this time of year, we should recognize and pay tribute to those sentiments, for they are the stuff out of which a better future can be built.
To summarize, the heads of the NATO governments and their associates labored earnestly during the week to continue the strengthening of our common security. We all realize that adequate three-strength work, three-world strength, moral, economic, and military, is, under present circumstances, our most effective deterrent to war. Moreover, it provides the basis for our best hope for progressive disarmament and improved understanding between East and West. Every American shares this hope with our NATO partners. Beyond any doubt, we all are prepared to make any necessary sacrifice to sustain and advance that hope. At the end of the conference, I express once more, as I have so often before, a constant readiness on the part of Secretary Dulles and myself personally to make any conceivable effort that might realistically help to reduce world tensions. Unfortunately, the attitude of the Soviets toward the free world has, for years, alternated between threat and blandishment. Their words, their pretensions, their actions have all failed to inspire confidence in free men. To bring about such an easing of tension, we believe that clear evidence of communist integrity and sincerity in negotiation and in action is all that is required. Only with such evidence of integrity and sincerity, and with the spirit of conciliation on both sides, can there be achieved a definite beginning of progress toward universal security and peace, which the world so earnestly seeks. For no nation, for no individual among us, could there be a finer Christmas present nor a better New Year. Good night.
NBC has brought you a special report by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles on the recent NATO conferences in Paris. This program has come to you from the President's office in the White House in Washington, D.C.